Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. I'm your host, Mike Allen. You've probably heard of the Resolute Desk. It is the desk in the Oval Office in Washington, D.C., used by the president. What you may not know, though, is how Connecticut played a huge role in making this desk happen. And we're not just talking about supplying the lumber or the carpentry. No, it is much, much more. And here to tell us his fascinating story is an expert, thank goodness, on the topic, Steve Manuel. Steve's the executive director of the New London County Historical Society, and New London played a huge role in it. This week's trivia question: what's 90 feet tall and called a lifesaver by everybody in New London? We'll stick around after the main program for the answer to that question, because you'll then know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. Well, I wouldn't blame you for asking the question, what's a sea voyage from back in the 1800s have to do with the desk that the President of the United States uses every day in the Oval Office to get his work done? It is a little bit complicated, and frankly, that's why we're lucky to have with us today Steve Manuel. Steve is the executive director of the New London County Historical Society, and New London was hugely important in Connecticut's early shipping history as well as this story. They made boats, they conducted whale expeditions, they undertook maritime explorations, and shipped goods all around the world. Well, you know, just like the fisherman who throws in the hook and catches an old shoe instead of a fish, there was one particular whaling expedition out of New London that ended up with the cargo that nobody anticipated. Now, I don't want to spoil the outcome of the story just yet, so you're going to have to be patient. But what I can say right now is that all of this happened because of Europe's quest, dating all the way back to the 1500s, to find a direct route for sailing from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Steve, let's start off talking about the Northwest Passage. Now, to make it simple, obviously, Europe, with its advanced sailboating expertise and circumnavigating the globe and colonizing the world at this point in time, needed to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific more quickly, and they either had to sail around South America or sail around Africa, and they said, if we just go north of Canada, there's got to be a way to do it. But let's start off with, that's not so easy in the winter months, is it?
No, there's only so much time that there's actually free water in that area, in the Arctic Ocean. So they're limited to the specific months, May, June, July. When they were sailing in the Northwest Passage, or were they sailing in the Arctic Ocean, they made plans to actually winter over. They would freeze in the ice while they were discovering. So they needed to find a passage that would allow them open water to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific. That's really what they were looking for.
And when they're going through this waterway, even in the so-called warm months, you're still having to duck icebergs.
You're having to duck flow, which is the pan ice. It's frozen solid, and then it starts to break up, and these pieces of ice are coming in. Not just icebergs, which are a different animal, but those pieces of ice that are coming at the ships. You have to dodge that. They were pretty ingenious. They would use icebreakers. They would reinforce their hulls. Eventually, they would use copper sheeting, but they would also attach themselves to icebergs, and they would sail behind them attached to the iceberg, and the iceberg would deflect the flow and leave black water behind it, keeping the ship safe. It was pretty ingenious.
And they were able to do this because the iceberg itself was flowing in the current, right?
That's correct.
So now, that's one thing for the ships, and that's no minor point. What about for the poor folks on the ships? It must have just been treacherous conditions.
Well, it's constantly cold, and I can actually draw from my own experience. I was in the Navy, and when I was on the Nimitz and we were in the North Atlantic, if you fall off the ship, they're not going to turn around because you're not going to survive that water. So that's a danger. have wind, it gets icy in the cabins, especially before the 19th century. They started this exploration in the 15th century. But before the 19th century, men would be huddled in their cabins with blankets around them, and their breath would cause condensations in the cabins, which would freeze. Their journal entries, which would describe how a mariner would be curled up in their blanket, and the blanket at their feet would be frozen, and at their chest, where they were the warmest, their core would be wet and drenched. So it's just overall, being a mariner was difficult. Being in the Arctic, it was incredibly difficult.
When you talk about frozen, I mean, did they have cases of frostbite and having to amputate people?
Not all ships had ship surgeons. We see that in the movies. So they would have someone who could do that kind of thing. So frostbite was a thing. Malnutrition was a thing. The food that they were getting, you have to think about any food that they had during Arctic exploration was brought to them by support ships. So you still had your salted meat and your hardtack, and they would trade with the Inuits for fresher food. They would hire Inuit hunters to actually go out and get them fresh food. When you're bringing Inuit people, you're exposed to a whole different, on both sides, a whole different set of bacteria that you're not immune to. So you have all that issue going on.
Now, if I'm going to drive out to visit you from Danbury to New London, and I'm driving on I-95, I've got these things called rest areas where I can pull over and get some food and whatnot. I read in your notes that, I hope I got this right, that the Dutch even had some sort of formal or permanent locations in that Northwest Passage area where they could, where you could stop and at least talk to them and see about getting some food. Is that accurate?
That is true. They had trading posts. The Dutch would set up trading posts in the area, and they would do that. They would trade with the natives, and that's just like you would see a trading post in the lower 48. They would have trading posts in different stops where the crew could barter with the natives, barter with the Dutch. They could get news, that kind of thing that you would always see at those kinds of places.
Interesting. Now, they go in, and they still haven't found it, and they have a guy who's high up in the Admiralty of the British Navy, and he's about to retire, and the last order he gives is to send this guy Franklin out to say, all right, I've been waiting to do this my entire career. Go do it for me. Go find the Northwest Passage, Franklin. And tell us the story. What happens?
Well, Franklin uses the Erebus and Terror, which are two British bombardier ships, which were actually part of the Battle of Groton Heights here in Connecticut. They outfitted the ships for Arctic exploration. And Franklin, he set out in 1845 to go and look for the Northwest Passage. He went in and did what you typically do when you're doing Arctic exploration. And he dealt with the natives. He got maps. He hired his crew. He got tender ships. And he went in and he became lost. Erebus and Terror were really good ships, but he just disappeared.
Now, if I have it right, he got locked in somewhere near Melville Island. That's pretty far west.
He did. He got significantly in. We found the Erebus and Terror actually in 2014 and 2016. He was south of Melville Isle, and they found the Erebus and Victoria Strait.
Now, somewhere I read, and I'm not sure if it was in your notes or some other reading, where they actually have a date of death for Franklin. Did they end up finding a diary on those boats?
Yes. Well, they found a number of things. The Royal Museum in Greenwich has the materials. The date of death of Franklin is in the ship's journal.
So he takes off in 1845. He doesn't come back. His poor wife is distraught. Even though these voyages take a couple of years, still he has not come back. She is absolutely beside herself, and she starts putting on some pressure to try and find her husband.
That's right. Eventually, her efforts became of international interest. The King of England at the time put up a £10,000 reward. Later on, through Lady Franklin's efforts, that reward became £20,000 to anyone who rendered aid to the expedition. And that's how an American merchant named Henry Grinnell got involved. He was born in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and he had his own mercantile out of New York. And he was used to dealing with the English. So he got involved with the search for the Franklin expedition at the behest of the president.
Now, to keep the story from getting too complicated, the British finally send out an expedition. It's 7 years after Franklin's taken off. Four ships in the flotilla, one of them named the Resolute. The Resolute and her supply vessel were supposed to search the northern part of the Northwest Passage. The expedition commander and the other two ships were going to search the southern part of the passage. They didn't find Franklin's expedition. The Resolute became trapped in ice. They were prepared for that, and they were ready to winter through the ice, and they were ready for the spring thaw, but the chief commander didn't think it was going to thaw. He ordered the crew to abandon the Resolute and return on the supply vessel. So the British expedition ended. The Resolute was left behind in frozen ice. And since the Resolute is key to this story, now we got to talk about the New London connection that finally fits in, because this is a great part of the story. Now, we're talking about a sea captain from the area named Buddington and a firm called Perkin and Smith. So let's start with Perkin and Smith. Who were they? What were they? And how did they get involved in all this?
The Perkins and Smith firm was a partnership between three men. Elias Perkins II was descended from Nathaniel Shaw, one of the original founders here in New London. Nathaniel Shaw was a wealthy merchant captain, and he built a very large house here in New London, which you can still visit. I'm actually sitting in it. Elias Perkins was still in the mercantile business. He was an affluent man who had gone to Yale but left Yale because he was ill. His brother was Nathaniel Shaw Perkins Jr. They called him Shaw because there's a lot of Nathaniel Shaws around. He went on to Yale and he became a businessman. And the two of them, with the wealth that they had accumulated and a partner named Franklin Smith, who was a retired whaling captain, formed the Perkins and Smith whaling firm, which became pretty affluent pretty quick in their first year. They had about 24 ships. And among those ships was a ship called George Henry. And when you have a whaling firm, you find captains, and you often find a captain you like, and you hire him consistently. And Perkins and Smith was dealing with a man named James Buddington. He was born in Groton, and he ran away to farm in Illinois and got tired of farming. So he divorced his wife and came back to New London to be in the whaling industry. And they hired Buddington for three voyages. The first ship they captained was called Amoray, and it belonged to Perkins and Smith, and he went up to the Davis Strait hunting whales. His next voyage was the George Henry, and that's how he became involved with the whole discovery of the Resolute, because the George Henry was the ship that was going up into the Davis Strait to look for whales when they stumbled across Resolute.
Now, he was frustrated, if I have the story right, because there weren't many whales. Like you said, it was not the beginning of the whaling industry, but toward the end.
Well, we're looking at a period where they had no idea of what sustainable use was. New London County was the second largest whaling city. New London itself was the second largest whaling city in the country. So we're looking at a number of things going on here. They have the lack of whales. They can't find them anymore because they overfished the resource. And then people were getting out of the business because Standard Oil was starting up. So you're seeing alternatives and easier methods for getting things that would be used, that whale oil would be used for, to kind of replace that resource of whales.
So now he's on this ship. He is contracted to find whales and whale oil, and he's not having much luck on that. And instead he spots this ship just floating in the water, right?
They just see the ship, and it wasn't floating in a way that you think. It was unique in that it was put up for almost dry dock. So when they abandoned the ships, they removed the sails and they tilted the yards and they left her. And that's what he saw. So it was an unusual sight to begin with. And he spotted her, and he was still 3 days. It took 3 days for his crew to leave his ship. He asked three men to leave the ship, and they used ice rafts, which is just a piece of ice that they cut, and used that to kind of row over. And they would have a wooden sledge on board that ice raft, and then they would push their supplies. And these three men took 3 days to get aboard the ship that they spotted. And then they went below, and they saw just it abandoned. There was food on the tables and brandy there. The men actually stopped and had a drink of brandy because it was there and it was available. And then they discovered a plaque in the journal, and they signaled to George Henry in Buddington that they'd found HMS Resolute.
Now, this is going to be the point where a key decision was made that we don't want to spoiler alerts here. We'll tell the rest of the story later. But Buddington has to make a decision now because he came up with one ship and he's going to go back with two, and he can drive one of them, but he needs somebody else for the other. So tell me that part of the story.
So Buddington saw that there was no way he was going to get the whales he needed in order for the whole whaling venture to be profitable. So when he saw Resolute, he saw salvage. So typically, if he could navigate that ship back to New London, that ship could be sold and everybody would get salvage prize money. So he had to make a choice. What was he going to do? Now, his first lieutenant, his first officer at the time was a man named O'Malley. This was his first real voyage, and he was nervous. Now, Resolute was old, and it was battered, and he decided that O'Malley could not possibly get Resolute back to New London without it sinking. So he decided to take command of the Resolute himself, and he put O'Malley in charge of the George Henry, and he sent him back to New London. Buddington took 13 men, including the ship's carpenter, and they went aboard Resolute, and they sailed it back to the city of New London. Now, we're looking at the end of the whaling industry, and we're having a difficult time, you know, meeting bills and that kind of thing. And we're leading up to the panic of 1857, which would impact the economy of the United States. So Franklin Smith, who was a sea captain, decided that he was going to go to the Desolation Islands and get seal oil. And he was on his way back to New London. Elias Perkins was in Hawaii. So the only person who happened to be in the area was Shaw. And he was there to receive the Resolute.
Now, the fun part of this story, if you want to call it fun, is that this dispute, or at least an interpretation of shipping law, without going into every letter that was written back and forth, if you could kind of summarize how that played out.
It was a difference between British salvage law and American salvage law. In order for Resolute to be legal salvage, the British had to give up their claim. And when the British gave up their claim, they designated Buddington the beneficiary of that claim. And that's where the dispute came in. The Perkins Smith whaling firm believed they owned the rights to the salvage, and Buddington was given the rights to the salvage. So Shaw was here, and he wrote pretty much everyone. The concession that the British Admiralty made was the salvage rights were going to be given to the owners of the George Henry, not even naming Perkins and Smith, but calling the owners of the George Henry the beneficiary of any salvage rights that involved HMS Resolute.
So now Buddington is cornered out, and the owners, who at that time then were Perkins and Smith, are got to be pretty happy.
Well, they were pretty happy, but we're now bumping up into 1857. So Perkins and Smith goes into receivership because banks are closing all over the New York and Connecticut area. Perkins and Smith doesn't have any liquid cash in order to meet their debts. Resolute, which is now part of their fleet, becomes the property of Henry Haven, who buys their ships because the Perkins and Smith firm folds. So now Henry Haven is the owner of the George Henry and do the salvage money for that ship. Another effort was made to actually purchase the Resolute, refit her, and give her back to England as a gift to patch up United States-British relationships. The United States government eventually purchases Resolute to refit her and give her back to England. And that $40,000 goes to Henry Haven, who refuses to pay the crew and the captains their shares. And Haven's argument was that when Buddington left George Henry to Captain Resolute, he abandoned his command and wasn't due any of the prize money. So Buddington actually brought Haven to court, and the court did award the crew their shares of the prize money, but Buddington didn't get a dime. The court sided with Haven in that Buddington abandoned his command.
So the government pays the $40,000, turns out, to Haven for the ship, and they decide to restore it, which occurred, I guess, in New York City. And then it takes a month to sail it over to Portsmouth, England, and hand it over to Queen Victoria.
They succeeded in their goal, and that is improving relations between the United States and England. And Queen Victoria was very happy when Resolute appeared. She actually was there to receive the ship, and she stood on the deck and said, thank you for returning to us our ship. And they used her as a museum, so people could go and they could visit on board the Resolute. And then eventually Resolute was decommissioned in 1879. And after she was decommissioned, they took and they broke her up. Victoria commissioned three desks. She kept a writing table for herself, the small table, and they put it on her royal yacht, the Victoria and Albert. The other desk she had done was a small woman's secretary. And that was gifted to Henry Grinnell for his efforts, because Grinnell was really part of that effort to get Resolute purchased by the United States and gifted back to England. The third desk was a partner's desk. It was gifted to the president, to Rutherford B. Hayes, in 1880, to be the president's desk. The desk that Victoria gave the president didn't have a panel on the front with the presidential seal. The presidential seal plate was put in by FDR because he didn't want people to see his legs.
The Northwest Passage was finally found, but not without quite a few unsuccessful efforts. Canada, for example, celebrates Thanksgiving Day in honor of one attempt back in 1578 by Sir Martin Frobisher. He tried to find the passage, but he did not succeed, as we know. It wasn't until 1906, only about 120 years ago, that the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen became the first person to successfully navigate the Northwest Passage. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Steve Manuel. He's the executive director of the New London County Historical Society. The answer to this week's trivia question, what's 90 feet tall and called a lifesaver by everyone in New London? Well, the answer is the Harbor Lighthouse at the mouth of the Thames River, where New London meets Long Island Sound. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we're going to put the spotlight on Connecticut's lighthouses along Long Island Sound and speak with the person who runs the oldest lighthouse museum in the country. Yes, it's in Connecticut, Stonington to be exact. Amazing Tales from Off and On, Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe and please stay healthy.